party, they will do a smaller scale promotion because they know the fact that this party is happening, so there won't be a big expense per se. Well, so they will hire maybe two DJs and
even so, but still, when I feel like work together, because sometimes you see, oh, you look at the market, as you say, the downtown and the big this and that. Everybody want a place to go still.
Yeah, but there's a strategic way in doing it too, you know. Can't because wait. In Montreal, you have different, even though we are part of the Caribbean community, you have different aspects of partying. You have the soca parties, you have the old school parties, like the mature crowd, the young teen parties. You have different people that support different events. So, like, you can have a party for a mature crowd tonight. You can also have a party, a soca party, and you can also have a teen party, and each party will have their supporters. And then what it boils down to now is your promotion to get the other people. If your promotion is good, you will be the person who get the people at the end of the night. Your job as a promoter is to promote. So promoting means you have to put out the energy and the effort to make sure that people come to support your event.
That's right. But the problem is, like I'm saying, I see majority of the adults, they're a big part in Maguan. And me see part of a big promotion Maguan, and then after last minute incident, certain a lot of flyers come out for them apart.
Like I said, the clubs, like for instance, let me show you. Caravan weekend. So
we're gonna talk about that next time, cause you know, say after hours is here, and we're gonna go over them time, and you know.
You'd be sure if you asked her just for a quick 5 minutes just to finish out this conversation, she wouldn't mind. You wouldn't mind.
It's all show
plans. Oh, sorry about that. Okay. Yeah, but we can enter the conversation another time. That's no problem.
You know, because you know that's a serious. I'm gonna like at least you guys come in and we can add like enlighten with you guys and you wanna come from and you know. We'll talk next time about that scene. Sorry, Montreal people, instead of just a little vibe came in and the young youth, them are the future, so we have to talk to them, see? It's all about next week, same place, same time, see? So, after hours right here, they're going to take over, and you know, that's the way it is. Next week, positive. Gossip.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. What? Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Good afternoon, and you are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on SKUT. My name is Candace, and I'm your host for today's show. The interviews on today's show focus on the theme of pregnancy and birthing while in prison. We spoke with Victoria Law, who is based in New York, and JC, who is based in Canada. Both interviewees talked about the terrible conditions facing pregnant women and birthing women in prison, as well as some of the realities facing people who have just given birth while incarcerated. Stay tuned for those two interviews. But first, some news items. Our first news item is when we are rebroadcasting from prison radio in the United States and features Mumi Abu-Jamal and giving an update about his current condition, as well as his declining health status due to hepatitis C. Recently, Mumia's final appeal of his PA Department of Corrections grievance against the DOC's refusal to give Mumia any treatment was denied. Okay, it appears we will post that clip on our blog, which is prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. Shortly over a month ago, in the beginning of September, a settlement was reached in which the state of California agreed to reduce the use of solitary confinement in its prisons, as well as introduce strict limits regarding the prolonged isolation of inmates. The settlement is also expected to reduce the overall number of prisoners held in isolation units in California prisons. Additionally, many prisoners who have spent more than 10 years in isolation, which includes over 400 prisoners in Pelican Bay, will be released back into the general prison population. The settlement arose from a federal class action lawsuit filed in 2012 on behalf of a group of Pelican Bay prisoners in the Security Housing Unit, or SHU, who had been in isolation for over a decade. Although the case was filed on behalf of the prisoners, the settlement was negotiated with prisoner representatives, many of whom are part of a group called the Pelican Bay SHU Short Corridor Collective. Over 1,000 prisoners in the SHU went on hunger strike in July of 2011, and after no action was taken by the prison to review the policies in the SHU, despite prison officials' agreement to do so, the prisoners went on hunger strike again several months later. A third hunger strike happened in July of 2013 and involved more than tens of thousands of prisoners in Pelican Bay and many other prisons. To hear some of the testimonies of the Pelican Bay SHU Short Corridor Collective, you can again visit the Prison Radio Show archives at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. A group of activists formed a blockade at the entry and exit points of a privately owned and operated immigration detention center in Washington State last month. Shannon Young from Free Speech Radio News has more.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Realize
consciousness is affected.
There is this thing.
On.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Members of the Northwest Detention Center Resistance Coalition blocked access points to and from the facility in Tacoma Monday morning in what they say is a direct action to prevent deportations and call attention to profiteering from detention quotas. Protester Dean Spade described the scene.
15 of us here are locked together in the group I'm in, but there's people locked at three different entrances. There's the Raging Grannies at another location and another group. We've got our arms locked into these tubes. And we're just trying to stay as comfortable as we can in this awkward position. And we got a bunch of beautiful banners on the ground and listening to some music.
Spade says the group chose a Monday to protest because it's a day in which the center tends to transport immigrants to the airport for deportation to their countries of origin.
And that was Free Speech Radio News' Shannon Young with a report on the Northwest Detention Center Resistance Coalition's blockading of an immigration detention center in Washington State to prevent deportations and to call attention to the profiteering off of immigration jails. The action took place on Monday, September 21st. The Quebec government has announced that it will close Maison Tanguy, the largest of the two women's provincial prisons this coming February. Approximately 240 women prisoners will be moved to Le Clare in Laval, which will become a mixed prison. The government says that many of the male prisoners at Le Clare will subsequently be moved to other jails in the province, to Amos, Roberval, Sept-Îles, and Sorel, therefore further from Montreal and Laval public transit, making it potentially more difficult, timely, and costly for families and loved ones to visit folks in jail. The union representing prison guards further says this moving of prisoners intensifies the crisis of overcrowding in provincial jails. In the past decade alone in Quebec, the prison population has increased by 30%. The time is presently 5:10 p.m. and you are listening to the Prison Radio Show here on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at CKUT.ca. Today we'll be featuring an interview with Victoria Law. Victoria Law wrote the book Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. It was published in 2009. The most recent edition of In These Times publication includes a piece by Victoria about the struggles of pregnant women behind bars. We caught up with Victoria to talk about this important issue.
Secretary Jay Johnson released a statement indicating this.
I have been doing work specifically in women's prisons for the past number of years. I'm a birth worker, so I support folks who are having babies. And I've been doing some of that work inside, as well as some health and sexual reproductive health education inside.
I'm going to start with a side note and a question about language. When I initially wrote these questions, I used the language of pregnant people instead of pregnant women. Partly that's coming from a lot of folks have been trying to figure out language that takes into account the fact that not everyone who becomes pregnant identifies as a woman. However, you pointed out that the vast majority of people who are pregnant in jails and prisons identify as women. Do you want to talk a bit about the language you want us to use in our interview and why you want to use it?
Yeah, so I think I often will use that language interchangeably. And I don't use it interchangeably because it's the same, because it's quite different. But I use that language interchangeably because I don't think we've gotten to a moment in our language that actually encompasses what we're trying to say. And I don't think that saying women and pregnant people also, I don't like the and. The and doesn't feel good either. So I guess where I'm coming from is that I use a variety of language to talk about it. And yeah, I think just what you just did, naming that not everyone who is pregnant identifies as a woman. And also when we're talking about like building families, yeah, lots of people are pregnant and lots of people are involved in parenting. And parenting is a nuanced and complicated reality for families. But in terms of my own experience of supporting folks inside, so far have all the folks who I've supported have identified as women who are transitioning to parenting. Not necessarily all the folks that I've supported in the women's institution identify as women. But yeah, just wanting to name that.
Cool. Thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm. Can we start off talking about statistics? They can sometimes not tell us as much as we think, but we shall see. Do you know how many women are pregnant in prison in Canada?
I don't. And that's something that we don't actually know. So what this whole interview is I'm going to talk about my experience working in the Maritimes. And what I know is in the facilities that I have worked in and supported folks in, that lots of folks are pregnant and don't talk about it, especially, I don't know if your listeners know, and some of them probably do and some probably don't, but there's a big difference between federal facilities and provincial facilities. So federal facilities are plus 2 years, provincial are minus 2 years. And so a lot of my work is in a provincial facility, although I've done some at a federal as well. Yeah, that like folks get pregnant all the time. That's what happens. Women get pregnant. And there's lots of reasons why people wouldn't tell that to health staff at CSC or at the facility. So we don't actually have numbers on who's pregnant, but we know that pregnancy is a regular part of people's lives. People get pregnant and either choose to keep those pregnancies or not. So we don't have those numbers.
In your experience, what kind of conditions have you seen pregnant women face in prison?
Yeah, I mean, so I guess just to take a step back and talk about what are the conditions in prison, which I know you probably talk a lot about on your show, but then how that's exacerbated during pregnancy. So what we know is that already prison is not a safe place. It's not a healthy place. And what pregnant people face is a lack of, like everyone, there's a lack of health care. And so pregnant women aren't given any of the, you know, really, I think, fundamental and basic healthcare that we would give to folks on the outside, on the inside. So what I've seen in my context is people not getting the critical, like, prenatal care that they need in terms of regular prenatal appointments, regular prenatal support in terms of, like, counseling and health, like, nutritional support. Really what I've been seeing is prenatal care from an institutional perspective is some prenatal vitamins and an extra glass of milk. So really, really inadequate. right? And what we know, and I think it's like important to talk about when we understand prisons as a point and a mode of surveillance and security, what we know is how that's heightened in prison. And also what we know is that women's bodies and people who's pregnant, their bodies are highly regulated and surveilled. And so that's even more in prison. And even more around this like context of like, who is fit for mothering? This whole idea of like, who is fit to be a mother? And so therefore part of that is like, who gets access to good care in terms of mothering? And because of the narrative and ideas about who women in prison are, those folks aren't given basic services. So for me, in my context, there's like folks doing work in the Maritimes around trying to bring more reproductive care services into women inside. And what we hear day in and day out every time that we do that is what the lack, just the basic lack that people aren't getting access to services both on the outside and then are being denied services on the inside. Does that help? Does that kind of help give context for your question?
Yes, definitely. We're airing an interview with Victoria Law on the same show where we're going to be airing your interview. And she talked about a lot of similar things happening in the United States. And one of the big things she talked about was that a lot of the women she was corresponding with who were pregnant inside at different points in time, they mentioned just being hungry all the time, that like the nutritional access in prison was so hard and that was like a huge thing for them. Does that come up in your experience as well?
Definitely. And like a lack of services, like definitely I think on all, like I would say nourishment in the fullest sense of the word, right? So not just in terms of food, but this is a time when people are trying to prepare for their changing, either they're expanding their family, maybe they already have kids, maybe they have other kids who are in state care, but trying to expand their capacities to welcome a new person into their life, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we see on the outside is generally there's like a lot of support around like supporting people's capacities around being good parents or being good moms in terms of like supporting people get their tangible houses ready. Like, do you need a car seat? Like all those little things to more things like parenting groups, support groups around trying to think about how do you want to raise your children? What makes sense for you? And people don't get any of that access inside, right? And that, I think, for me, when I think about and understand prisons as a tool of state violence and prisons as a tool of control, and thinking about who is incarcerated and whose families are being surveilled by prisons, how is this a part of like a longstanding tool to keep control and surveillance over certain families? So if someone's incarcerated and then they don't have access to these resources, and then you're incarcerated, so state services is involved in watching, right? In like, is called because maybe you're not, the idea is you're not fit to be a good parent, but you don't actually have access to basic resources that would support your parenting skills. There's a higher probability that your kids are going to be taken away after. So how is this like a part of a narrative and a self-fulfilling prophecy about who gets to parent and who doesn't, who gets to be a mom and who doesn't, and who's fit to be a mom and who isn't, which is just like really untrue, right? All of this is about, it's about resources. The majority of folks inside are pretty much all poor folks, right? That's the reality, because folks with money can navigate around the criminal legal system. For the most part, and the higher percentage of majority of folks inside are folks of color, indigenous folks. Yeah, so just like wanting to name that reality around that the conditions are set up for certain, to enact certain kinds of power in our society.
Do you want to talk a bit about the kinds of conditions that folks inside in Canada face giving birth while incarcerated? There's been a lot of controversy in the news in the United States, at least, about like pregnant women getting shackled while they're giving birth and things like that, that I think has gotten a lot of attention. But when we talked to Victoria Law, she was focusing on some things that didn't get as much attention. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts on basic conditions that people face while giving birth in Canada.
Totally. And I mean, I think a recent example of a case that got a lot of attention in our context in Ontario was Julia Bilbata, who was the mom who was in solitary confinement and delivered her child on her own, who was a breech baby in solitary, and was like told the guards that she was in labor and was denied care, right? And so had to do that on her own. And she's currently in legal battles around the reality of that. So I think that that's, But her story, sadly, I think is one story that we have heard, and there's so many stories that we don't hear. I think just to name again that so much of this is context. So both that there is huge difference between the federal facility and the provincial facility, but then also prison to prison, every prison is so different. So what I have seen personally, number one, folks in general don't usually give birth inside the prison itself. So usually they're transferred to a nearby hospital. Number two, I would say that generally if someone is at a provincial facility over a federal facility, the provincial prisons don't want to deal with birth. And so usually they let folks out like a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before their due date. So I just want to like put that in. I want really people to integrate the reality of that. So to imagine maybe you're picked up and incarcerated maybe 3 months into your pregnancy, 4 months into your pregnancy. You've been disconnected from all your community and family resources. You're inside, and then you're let out 3 to 1 week before your baby's going to come. So yeah, just again to name the reality of how our system sets people up for failure. It's not actually about supporting people. It's not actually about supporting families and building people's capacities because there's nothing about that that's supportive. So yeah, just to go back to that, generally I would say at the provincial facility, they try to let people out right before their due date because they don't want to deal with it, is my perspective. At a federal facility, they're transferred to the local hospital to give birth. At the federal facility in the Maritimes, there is a program that supports moms and babes staying together after they give birth. That has been used a handful of times in the past decade, but is being used. It's available for certain families that meet certain criteria. But in terms of giving birth, there is rumors about shackling. I've never witnessed that personally as someone who's supporting folks. And but yeah, people are shackled in different ways to go to prenatal care appointments. So shackling is something that is used. It depends on whether they're – it's less common in Canada for, like, the full shackles, so the shackle of, like, the feet and the arms. More often people are handcuffed. But, like, to put that in context, like, you know, recently someone shared a story with me of, like, having an epidural, like quite a heavy epidural. And for folks who don't know what that is, that's a pain management drug that's given through someone's – in their back. And – I've been doing birth work for a decade. People can't really move around with an epidural. Maybe they can like get up and walk a little bit with like some support, but barely. So it's not like, you know, so like someone recently was giving birth and they were given an epidural and there were like, you know, two guards in the room while this person was giving birth, right? It's not like, so the level of security, it's not just about shackling, but it's also the level of security that is involved.
In December of 2013, the BC Supreme Court ruled that mothers and babies have the constitutional right to be together, even when the mother is incarcerated. The decision came after a lawsuit was brought by two women who had been incarcerated, and the lawsuit came in the wake of the cancellation of a program for mothers and newborn babies at a correctional center in BC in 2008. I don't know if you want to talk about like what the impacts of that decision were that you saw as far away as the East Coast, but... Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about accessibility of a program, well, non-accessibility of a program that you've seen enacted in one prison. So if you can talk a bit about whether or not this decision had any impact on the programming that you saw, and then also talk a bit about like the non-accessibility of this program maybe.
Yeah, this is a good question. So I think that... I can't say really about what the decision had an impact on this program per se, but what I can say is from talking to people who I care about and know and who work, do similar work to what I do in BC is just, you know, how profoundly they talked about the shift, that when this program was closed, which I think is really interesting and people don't always talk about. So one shift that they shared that I thought was really interesting was the higher level of violence that happened after the program, like after the program stopped. And so I want to break that down for a second. And I think, you know, in our facility, we saw a similar, or not, I shouldn't say my facility, but in the facility in the East, we saw a similar shift when smoking became bans. Like, there was a higher level of violence when smoking was no longer allowed. And I just want, again, like, people to pause and think about that and think about what it means. Specifically, I'm talking to people who haven't been incarcerated and who think about incarceration but haven't experienced incarceration themselves, what it means to have increased level of surveillance and scrutiny on people's, like, bodies and lives, and the ways that little bits of autonomy, when those are taken away, and little bits of humanity, when those are taken away, how that impacts us. So I think for me, I just want to, like, link this back into the conversation around, yeah, just envisioning difference. But I guess to go back to your first question, yeah, this program I think is a really powerful one. Like, I believe really deeply in what I know is that families should stay together, and ripping families apart doesn't do anyone justice. So to go back to what I was just saying about the increased level of violence is that this program isn't only impacting the kids who are still able to stay with their families, the moms who are still able to be with their kids, but how it impacts actually the entire institution and the way that keeping a sense of humanity in such an inhumane place is so critical. That said, I believe in the program, but I don't believe that prisons are a safe place for families.
One of the big themes that keeps coming up when I talk to folks about this issue is the idea of alternatives to incarceration for pregnant women and mm-hmm. new mothers. Do you know of any alternatives to incarceration that exist for women in Canada?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think one of the big things that we see in lots of places, so I guess I just want to name, number one, that moms are the fastest growing prison population in Canada. And wanting, again, people to, like, really hear that and integrate that, like, what is that about? And the majority of mothers who are being criminalized or doing it, it's about, like, survival and it's about economy. So the majority, at least what we see in the East Coast, and from my understanding, this is the same across Turtle Island, the majority of folks are being criminalized around things like sex work, like drugs, either using drugs or trafficking drugs, fraud are the most common ones. So, like, crimes that are, again, about economy, and most of them are, it's about feeding their families and survival and keeping their families safe. And a lot have connections to drugs. So for me, when I talk about alternatives, a huge part comes back to social conditions and the social conditions and realities of prisons. And I think that if we were to imagine a place where people could support and raise families with the resources that they need, that would be a huge, for me, transformative moment. So one example of that is, for example, like harm reduction housing. So something that we face in the East that's a huge reality is that most of the housing for families, so most of the housing for moms and kids to access, are not a harm reduction space. Like, people cannot be using and accessing that space. So what does it mean if you can't actually access housing to raise your family? It means that you can't, right? So that would be one alternative that I think is, like, a very, actually quite simple model that we could invest in across the country, having harm reduction housing. We know there's a lack of housing across the country. One is about straight up economy. So why is it that people are choosing, and again, I think this is, like, a smart, I want to, like, validate and support the choices that people make in trying to survive in this world, that people feel like it's easier to survive by doing illegal, by, like, working in a legal system than working under minimum wage, because minimum wage is, like, so impossible for anyone to live on. So having an economic reality where people can actually raise their families and be supported, I think, is a real alternative. Yeah, I think for me, again, going back to what I was talking about earlier, incarceration is about keeping things in place. The reality is that we have more kids in youth facilities than we do, like, specifically, we have more Indigenous kids in youth facilities than we ever have had in all of residential schools. It's about keeping a certain narrative and certain, yeah, like, keeping a certain place of power alive. And so when I think about alternatives, I mean, fundamentally, I think more than anything, I think about addressing the root issues of violence and of criminalization.
I have two more questions for you. One is we have listeners of the radio show who are currently incarcerated, and I was wondering if you have any resources that you can point people to on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is definitely, this is a harder one. So specifically for folks who are for pregnant folks and for moms.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. This is a hard one because it's so context-based and so specific. But I would really encourage folks to connect with local folks who are doing prison support work. And if they're not addressing issues around pregnancy and parenting, then they should be, again, because the majority of folks who are inside are parents. I can really only speak to the East Coast.
And then for folks on the outside, are there places where people can go to hear stories of women who've been pregnant and been inside, or hear stories of folks who've had those kinds of experiences?
Yeah, I definitely think there's lots of places. I think that there's lots of writing from folks inside that people can get their hands on. One book that I really appreciate is Words Without Walls, which is comes out of the East Coast. It comes out of Books Beyond Bars, put it together, and it's folks from inside the Nova facility and the Burnside facility, poetry and art. Sadly, there is a serious lack of Canadian content for sure, in general. But I guess one thing I want to bring up is, which is a whole other maybe program that you could do, but the way in which, whose voices around incarceration and around criminalization are given space and time, specifically for non-incarcerated people. I guess to talk about my own experience, I've never been incarcerated. I have loved ones who are, and who have been, both in my biological family and in my extended family. And I get asked to speak about prisons quite a bit. And that doesn't really feel right for me as someone who's never been incarcerated. And I often ask friends who have been incarcerated to take my place to do that. But when those folks do go on the radio or speak on a panel, often their experience is written off a lot, because I think about some of it is about language, and I think some of it is about the intense stigma around incarceration. So I would really encourage folks who haven't been incarcerated to really open up their ears and eyes to the stories that they're not hearing that are right in front of them in their community, because I think it's a false reality to imagine that that your life hasn't been touched by incarceration. And how is that a part of this narrative and this idea and this othering process that's about walls, it's about borders, it's about creating distance? There is a lot of stories that aren't quoted and interviewed in this specific way, but have a lot to share with us and a lot of knowledge to share.
That was JC speaking to us about conditions in women's prisons in the Maritimes. We were talking about pregnancy in prison, lack of health care, and who gets considered a good mom, quote unquote. You can check out the next airing of an interview on the same theme on our next show, which is going to be October 23rd at 11 a.m. Next, we are going to hear Victoria Law, who is talking about her new piece about the struggles of pregnant women behind bars in the United States. The piece was published in the most recent edition of In These Times, which you can also check out online at inthesetimes.org. This is Prison Radio here on CKUT.
My name is Victoria Law. I am a freelance writer specializing in looking at the intersections of incarceration, gender, and resistance, mainly in prisons and jails in the United States. I am the author of a book called Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, that looks at instances of both individual resistance and collective organizing in women's jails and prisons across the United States. And most recently, I finished a 6-month investigation into conditions of pregnancy behind bars, again, across the United States for women who enter jail or prison while pregnant.
So You sort of gave us the segue into this next question. You recently published an article for the publication In These Times about women who are imprisoned and pregnant. Today we're going to talk more about the article and the issues that it raises. So can we talk about numbers to start? How many women are pregnant in prison in the United States?
So there actually is not hard and fast data about how many women who are currently behind bars are pregnant on any given day or any given month. The data that has been collected is a little bit on the old side. So in 2004, the Bureau of Justice Statistics, which keeps statistics on incarceration across the nation, found that 3% of women in federal prisons and 4% of women in state prisons were pregnant upon arrival. And in 2002, the Bureau of Justice Statistics found that 5% of women who enter local jails were pregnant when they arrived. So these numbers are a decade old, or these statistics are a decade old. But if these rates remain current, it seems that there's a little less than 9,500 pregnant women incarcerated annually. But when I did public information requests to different jails and prisons, the way that they keep data makes it really hard to figure out how many people this actually applies to. So a couple of jails, instead of saying we have X number of pregnant women per month, they keep track by number of pregnancy-related medical visits that somebody has had. So this fluctuates wildly then. So in January, that number might be 10. In February, it might have dropped down to 2. Does that mean that there were 10 pregnant women in January and 2 pregnant women in February? Or does that mean that the jail was really on the ball about making sure that people had prenatal care in January, but something happened in February where only 2 women went and got a prenatal visit, or maybe 1 woman went twice to receive prenatal care and the other 9 women got no care that month. So it's hard to parse through this kind of data if they're keeping track in all sorts of wonky ways.
Yeah. Do you feel like you could speculate on why the data is kept in such haphazard ways, or, you know, what motivation do prison officials have for keeping data in this way?
Well, I don't want to speculate that there's some grand conspiracy, but one of the things that anybody working towards uncovering, you know, governmental data or governmental neglect or abuse is that if you don't actually have hard and fast numbers, then it's harder then to challenge what's happening inside. So if you don't know how many people are pregnant in a given jail or prison, then it's harder then to advocate and say, well, if you have 10 pregnant women per month, you need to then be providing these 10 women with proper medical care, as opposed to saying like, well, we don't actually know if we need to be bothering with medical care in this jail or prison because we don't know how many pregnant people we might have. So it's a little bit harder to find this information out and then push for change if you don't even know what that information is.
So the other part of the research that it sounded like you did for this article was that you reached out to women who are incarcerated across the country. And in the end, you interviewed 12 women, some of whom were still incarcerated, about their experiences with pregnancy in prison. Can you speak more broadly about the themes that came up in these interviews? It seems like the data you would get from doing those interviews is quite different than the haphazard data you would get from doing Freedom of Information requests to different prisons.
Yes. Well, one of the resounding themes for women there were two that were shocking and they kind of go hand in hand. One was women complaining that they always were hungry, no matter what, no matter where they were, whether they were in the jail or in the prison, regardless of whether or not the jail or prison provided special pregnancy diet, you know, understanding that women who are pregnant have different nutritional needs than women who are not pregnant or did not provide a special pregnancy diet. They all complained that they were hungry, that the food that was provided was inadequate for their needs and to satisfy their hunger, that they would often subsist on whatever things they could get from the prison commissary or the prison's store, which are not healthy items. You know, it's not like you get fresh fruit and fresh vegetables from the prison store. You know, you might be able to get trail mix, and then maybe you might get a few nuts along with all the other things in the trail mix. You might be able to get peanut butter, but it's not, you know, enough for maintaining the caloric and nutritional needs of somebody who's pregnant. The other resounding theme throughout all of these interviews was medical care. Women felt that either they were waiting a long time to get medical care, often under horrific conditions. Like they would have to wait for hours and hours, often in very uncomfortable positions. They would be threatened with disciplinary tickets, in which a prison guard can write you up and administer a punishment for things like leaning forward or leaning backward on a bench while you're waiting for hours for your medical visit. Some women reported not getting health care for long periods of time. One woman spent a couple of months not receiving any health, not receiving any prenatal care, even though she had informed jail officials that she was pregnant. And she said that when she was booked, she was clearly showing that she was pregnant. So it's not that she was booked at 1 month or 2 months into her pregnancy, but she said that she was clearly showing. And it wasn't until her second trimester that she was taken to the hospital. And by then she'd gone into premature labor. And when she got to the hospital, she delivered her baby, and the baby died shortly thereafter. And she strongly feels that had she been given medical care before this, they would have been able to save the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So, but then there are other times in which, while it wasn't a fatal lack of medical care, women were still not getting the same types of medical care and the same rate of medical care than they would have when they were outside. So they reported doctors being rude and short, or the nurses being rude and short, or even prison regulations just making it impossible to get that kind of care that they need. So one woman reported, you know, telling her doctor that she was hungry all the time. And the doctor said, okay, well, let me see if I can get you some extra food. But prison regulations say, no, you cannot, as a doctor, prescribe a woman extra food. You can't have extra food in the clinic for women to be able to eat, you know, because the prison food is not, it's not adequate for their needs. So his hands were basically tied. So even with the best of intentions, he was unable to basically do his job.
I feel like a lot of the things that you're bringing up are related to this next question, which is about like what kinds of conditions do imprisoned women, imprisoned pregnant women face. Is there anything that you feel like you haven't mentioned yet that fits in with this question around conditions?
Well, so in the United States, 22 states have laws that prohibit or limit the shackling of women, of pregnant women in jails and prisons. So shackling, for listeners who may not be aware of it, is this practice in which a person is handcuffed. From the handcuff, there is a chain that goes around, that attaches from the handcuffs to a chain around the waist. And for people who ride bicycles, imagine the chain that you use to like tie up your bicycle after you've ridden it and you go to the store. So imagine being pregnant and having that kind of a chain around your belly. And that you're, so you're attached from the hands to your waist. And then from your waist chain, there's another chain that leads to your ankles, which are cuffed together. And that's a practice known as shackling. And 22 states have laws that say, no, you cannot shackle pregnant women, especially not during labor and delivery. Like you might be able to shackle them during their first trimester, but definitely not you're transporting them during their last trimester, definitely not during labor, delivery, and postpartum recovery. But what I found is that even in states that had these laws, women still reported being shackled. So I interviewed a woman named Sierra who was 8 months pregnant when she entered the jail. The jail actually had no facility to take care of pregnant women, so they shipped her off to the prison, even though she was still awaiting trial. And in the United States, you go to jail usually while you're awaiting trial. And then once you get sentenced, you're sent to prison. But she was sent to the prison because the jail didn't know how to deal with a pregnant person. And even though Washington State had passed a law stating that she was not to be shackled because she was in her last trimester, every time she went to court, the jail officials would come and pick her up from the prison, and they would shackle her every which way. The law in Washington State also says that women are not to be restrained, even with handcuffs, during labor, delivery, and postpartum recovery. And shortly after she gave birth to her son, a guard handcuffed her to the hospital bed. And when I filed a public information request and asked specifically, well, why did you handcuff her? The prison said, well, review, which means that somebody looked at this after the fact, determined that she should not have been handcuffed. Well, this doesn't do very much for her because this has already happened. And then when I asked the jail, one of the explanations they gave was she was fully shackled because she had been pregnant at the time that the crime she was being charged with had been committed. She was facing felony charges. And if convicted, she might be sentenced to years in prison, which basically sums up most people sitting in jail awaiting trial, is that you're charged, and if convicted, you could face years in prison. So it seemed like a very broad loophole to be able to say, basically, we can shackle this person, you know, even though we have a law that says that we're not supposed to.
You also talked a bit in the article about the kinds of things that happen to women after they've given birth and are either taken back to the prison or are in the hospital. I mean, you were just talking about someone who was handcuffed to the bed after giving birth. Can you talk a bit about, like, I mean, I guess the situation where, like, women end up getting their kids taken away from them, that seems like a super common experience when someone gives birth and is in prison.
Yes. So most jails and prisons have a policy where a person can spends 24 to 48 hours in the hospital with their newborn. In some states, you don't even get to be with your newborn the entire time. So in New York State, you give birth and you're in the hospital prison ward and your baby is taken to the nursery. And it is up to the guard on duty when you're going to be escorted to the nursery and how long you're going to spend with your baby in the nursery. So it's not like you even get 24 hours or 48 hours to bond with your baby. You might get like 3 hours or 4 hours, you know, out of that period to be able to spend with your baby. In other states like Washington State, the baby is in the room with you. But again, it's only 24 to 48 hours. And in the United States, we have a something called the Federal Adoption and Safe Families Act, which was passed in 1997, which states clearly that if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state starts proceedings to terminate parental rights. And that termination is irrevocable, which means that you can get out of prison month 17 and have no more rights to that child than the stranger in the grocery store does. And given that for many mothers, their children are 5 times more likely to end up in foster care than the children of incarcerated fathers because you're often single heads of household before they go to prison, or they don't have that kind of same family support, and there's not that societal expectation that we support mothers in the same way that we support fathers. Their children tend to end up in foster care at a greater rate. And given the long sentences that many people face, they very well could have their rights terminated simply because their child has been in foster care for 15 months. So for Sierra, she was in prison and she initially fought to maintain custody. And finally, the social workers told her, well, if you continue fighting, we're going to just terminate your rights because you will lose. Or you can voluntarily sign away your rights, and you will then be able to get pictures of your child from the adoptive parents. But if you continue to fight this and you lose, you don't get anything. And so that was the choice she was faced with. So she signed away her rights. She received one visit from her son. He was 1 year old. So she had not seen him for a year. He didn't know who she was. He was totally confused. He played with her. You know, he wasn't not nice to her or, you know, not screaming his head off the entire visit. But she said he didn't know who she was. And she hasn't seen him in person since then. And this happened. This kind of story happens again and again and again across the country.
In the article, you referenced the UN rules for the treatment of women prisoners and non-custodial measure for women offenders, which is also known as the Bangkok rules. Can you talk about what stood out for you in these rules?
What stood out for me in these rules is this recommendation that for any pregnant woman or for a child's primary caregiver, what should happen is that they should not be taken into custody, meaning that we should not be looking at jails or prisons or any sort of locked down setting, you know, for people who are either pregnant or are, you know, taking care of young children. Like, instead, we should be looking at what are alternatives to incarceration? What do these parents to be, their children and their families need in order to survive and thrive? Like, why are we locking them up rather than trying to address the underlying reason as to why they broke the law and why they're in these illegal activities? Mm-hmm. So that stood out to me because pregnancy and parenting are very rarely taken into consideration in the U.S. prison system. None of the women I interviewed said that the judge cared whether or not they were pregnant. Only one woman was able to have her baby outside, and that was because her family finally was able to come up with the bail money to bail her out, and the judge was willing to let them do that so she could have her baby outside. Had her family not had that money, the judge was not going to say, I see that you're pregnant with twins. You know, I think that you should be able to have your babies on the outside and be able to get proper medical care and be able to access the food that you need and be able to bond with your babies for a month before I sentence you to prison. It was all reliant on the fact that she was able, her family was able to come up with that.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of alternatives to incarceration already exist for pregnant women and mothers in the United States?
In New York, there are a couple, and I want to be very clear that when I talk about real alternatives, not prison alternative, like quote-unquote alternatives that are actually variations of the prison system. So in Delaware, there is a home for pregnant women and new parents, which is better than nothing, right? It's better than nothing, but this should not be held up as the model, where there's a group home for pregnant women with drug addictions who might otherwise be sent to prison, and they're provided with meals, prenatal vitamins, clothing, toys, classes on infant care and breastfeeding and parenting and nutrition. But it's still a down facility. It's run by the Department of Corrections. If you mess up, you risk being taken out of this home and sent to prison. If you you're subject to all the same rules and regulations as you would be in a prison. And it doesn't actually help you survive and thrive on the outside. It doesn't, you know, encourage independence and autonomy and trying to figure out how best to survive and thrive in this world. But then in New York, there are a couple of projects which do that, are not run by New York State prison system or any local jail, but do work with women who are either pregnant or parenting, provide them with a stable place to live, provide them with classes and resources that start to address some of these underlying issues. You know, like, did you graduate high school? If you haven't graduated high school, what needs to happen so that you can get your general equivalency diploma, what the high school equivalent is here in the United States? You know, like, what do you need in terms of being able to find employment? What do you need in terms of support around your parenting? If you have a substance abuse issue, what do you need to, you know, like, to work through that. So rather than looking at this as a punitive model, it looks at, you know, at pregnant and parenting women as people who are going to be parents of their children, members of the community, as people rather than as prisoners.
Do you feel like you could speak to what's missing amongst those alternatives to incarceration that already exist?
Well, I think, one, there's small alternatives to incarceration. And so if you, I mean, there's a tremendous number of people who cycle through the jails and prison system every day. So having a project which can house 10 to 20 people, while amazing for those 10 or 20 people who are able to access that alternative to incarceration, still doesn't do anything for all the people who can't. One of the other things is that, like, if you don't, say, live in a place like New York, there may not be an alternative for you. It might just be you go to jail or prison and that's it. So say Oklahoma, which has the highest female incarceration rate in the country, does not seem to have these kinds of alternatives to incarceration for pregnant and parenting women. And there are so many women who would benefit from being able to stay with their children, being able to be pregnant and getting support, you know, while they work through whatever it is that got them in the criminal legal system, whether it is, you know, like substance abuse, whether it is poverty, whether it is racism. And while it shouldn't be on the person to address racism, they might then be able to find some tools and strategies to navigate being a woman of color in a very racist society in ways that hopefully don't re-entangle her in the criminal justice system. So, but if you don't live in a place like New York and are not one of the handful of people that manage to get into a program, your alternative, your options then are jail and prison, and maybe a prison nursery program if you are in one of the few states that have them.
That's it for my questions. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or that you feel like I missed?
I think that one of the things, when we think about people who are pregnant behind bars, one of the things that I want to stress is that we should not separate people into deserving and not deserving. We should say everybody has the right to adequate food. Everybody has the right to adequate health care. Everybody has, you know, the right, unless they've proven otherwise, to be able to raise their families and parent their children. And we shouldn't divide this into people who have been charged with nonviolent offenses versus people who have been charged with violent offenses. Because even people who have made mistakes which have harmed other people, which have physically harmed other people, deserve all of the same things as people who are charged with nonviolent offenses. So I also wanted to add that, so that way people can think about, you know, who we think about when we think of who's deserving of parenting and dignity and basic human rights.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the show. This article was really awesome. Do you know if folks in Canada will be able to access the article on the internet once it's out?
Yes. Okay. Yes. The article actually goes live on Monday, September 28th. So they'll be able to access it at inthesetimes.com.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing.
That was Victoria Law talking about her new piece about the struggles of pregnant women behind bars. The piece was published in the most recent edition of In These Times, which again you can check out online at inthesetimes.org. This is the Prison Radio Show here on CQUT 90.3 FM. Stay tuned for Upstage coming up next. If you missed our last show or want to catch up on old shows, you can check out our blog at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. Thanks to radioforall.net for hosting the episodes on their servers. The next Prison Radio Show will air on Friday, October 23rd, at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything that you've heard on today's show or you wish to be involved with the program, you can contact us at prison@cqut.ca. Formerly incarcerated people are especially